Wine is often considered something of an elite drink, where a select few know all the secrets, and the rest of us fumble around as best we can. What if everyone could learn about wine with no special training or pretensions? We can, says Eric Asimov, the chief wine critic at the New York Times. In his new book, How to Love Wine, a Memoir and Manifesto, he demystifies wine culture and explains why wine anxiety should be a thing of the past. His book is published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased to welcome Eric Asimov back to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
So what is what you call wine anxiety?
Well, I talk to people all the time about wine. And often it's as if they're confessing their troubles to me. And they'll tell me that they like wine, but all those aromas and flavors that people talk about all the time, they don't get that. That's not their experience with wine. And usually they conclude that there's something wrong with them. They don't have the right equipment or the right ability, and there's something lacking.
I mean, when people say things like there's a hint of raspberry and a little bit of chocolate in it, and maybe
exactly.
A taste of saddle. I've always wondered what the taste of saddle was.
It's usually sweaty saddle.
Well, where did those things even come from?
Well, they come from what's known as the tasting note. And if you look at the back of consumer wine magazines, you'll see hundreds of them each describing a bottle that a critic has taken a sip and spat it out and a sniff and written some notes about the wine. And in the old days, these were just personal notes that people in the wine trade used to jog their memories. And somewhere in the last 40 years or so, they became the kind of lingua franca for discussing bottles and describing them.
Well, how much can we even trust from that experience that those wine tasters are going through, the mass tastings where they might go through 100 wines, putting a little bit in their mouth, swishing it around, spitting it out, going to the next one? It seems to me you can get really confused, even if you're writing down those little tasting notes.
I think, in fact, that these are not very useful for consumers. The service that is performed is that an authority figure is attaching a score to these wines and, in a sense, making sense out of all those hundreds of bottles that you don't know about that you see on the wall in the wine shop or on the wine list.
Well, what I remember during the brief time that I actually read wine magazines, that the ones that were listed, judged, generally weren't at my local wine shop anyway, so it didn't matter.
Well, you know, that is a common thing, and it doesn't bother me because nowadays, you know, you can get wine anywhere. There are so many great shops, not just in New York City, but all over the country. And to simply rely on the closest shop, you know, at the corner is a mistake if you really want to seek out wines. I mean, the internet is a great tool for finding bottles.
Well, it's easy to understand why someone might be overwhelmed by a long wine list at a restaurant, but you can consult the sommelier, can't
Absolutely.
You? And in wine stores, can't you just ask the salesperson?
You know, we operate on a model now that I think is based in one sense. It's really a 19th century model in that we have a hierarchy of wines where you have Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne, these benchmark wines of the past, still at the top. Right now, we live in the greatest time in history to be a wine lover. We have a more diversity of great wines from more places than ever before, and so the choices can really seem overwhelming at times. In another sense, we're relying on a consumer model from the 70s, where we really didn't know much about wine, and there was very little trust in the world. You remember the old stereotype of the supercilious sommelier who's going to sneer at you and rip you off at the same time. And fear still governs our relationship with wine. And really, there's a lot of good information in wine merchants and sommeliers that we should make better use of.
Well, there have been sommeliers in my past who I have felt have been trying to get me to spend a lot more money
than
I wanted to spend. But today, most of them are, in fact, in a number of cases, I've had sommeliers recommend a wine that was less expensive than the one I inquired about. because they really do want to please.
I think they do, and in a sense, they're nice version of the old indie record shop clerks, where they're just sort of consumed with passion about what they're selling, and they want to find something that you're going to love too.
So, how did you first become interested in wine? Did it come because you were writing about food?
Well, I became passionate about food as a teenager, and became a food writer, and wine was always part of it. I always, you know, when I was eating dinner, there was wine at the table. There were friends and family at the table, and it was just a single tableau. And eventually, my focus shifted to the wine, and I wanted to write about it. But I think of it as food and just something that belongs on the dining table rather than something you want to isolate.
Didn't the beginnings of your serious dining begin with French food?
It did, yeah. Like many people my age, I'm in my 50s. I had my first food epiphany in the 70s in Paris at a restaurant that's still there, Bistro Allard. And the flavors were just so vibrant and different from the kind of TV dinner culture that I was coming from.
Well, in France, most of the wine lists are French wines. They have started including American wines and other wines in recent years, but it's still pretty heavily French. Is it best to pair the food with the local wine? In Italy, should you be only drinking Italian wines?
You know, that's you say most of the wine lists are French, but it depends on what part of the country you're going to. If you go to Burgundy, the wine lists are all Burgundy, more or less. Same is true in Bordeaux, and of course that's part of the fun when you're traveling to explore the region you're in and the foods and the wines, the cheeses and whatever. But you know, nowadays, and if you're in New York, there's no reason to do that. I mean, you can drink whatever you like if you're making a French recipe at home.
Well, the big trick, of course, is another thing you write about is the combination of wine and food, the pairing.
Yeah.
And that can become a real problem for
people.
Well,
I think we fetishize this idea that there's always a perfect wine for a particular dish. And again, that causes fear. You know, what if we're not equipped? We read the guidebooks and they tell us about judging the acid levels of the food and matching it with the wine. And it's crazy after a while.
And then the advice changes. For a long time, we were told that cheese always was to be paired with red wines.
Right.
Now I've been reading recently, no, well, maybe white wines in many cases. For a long time, I heard that the only wine to drink with Chinese food was Gewürztraminer. I never really liked that pairing. Now we hear Rieslings or Sauvignon Blancs and all sorts of other wines. Is it because we're getting more knowledgeable or just simply because the conventional wisdom is being questioned?
I think that any time you try to follow the conventional wisdom, you'll drive yourself crazy. And each time somebody says something different, it's kind of, you know, solidified into a rule rather than a recommendation. The cheese, for example. In fact, a lot of white wines go better with many cheeses than red wines. But that doesn't mean all cheeses should be consumed with white wine. I hate when you just rid yourself of centuries of thought because you've discovered something new.
Eric Asimov is my guest. He is the chief wine critic for the New York Times, where his weekly column appears in the dining section. His book, How to Love Wine, a Memoir and Manifesto. You mention in your book that you've been asked what wine to pair with pizza. And what do you suggest?
Anything you like. I mean, you know, pizza in
Doesn't
Italy.
Doesn't it depend whether it's pepperoni or not?
Well, see, that's where you can be driven crazy because, you know, the notes of mushroom and the pizza might pair with Pinot Noir, whatever. In Italy, they drink beer with pizza and Coca-Cola. You know, I like to drink Barbera with pizza, and I've also had champagne with pizza. So I, you know, just don't worry about it so much. I mean, that sounds very simple, and it sounds as if I'm almost being pedestrian about the wine pairing. But the fact is that if you really want to go into it, you can do that. But it's not so important that you should let that be an obstacle between you and having that simple pleasure.
In many of cookbooks and wine magazines, they actually suggest the wine to go with a dish. And then some of the – another one that we read for a long time that now is being questioned is what to have with turkey on Thanksgiving. It was always Zinfandel. Now I'm hearing Beaujolais or –
There's a zillion things, and you know, that's the problem. When you try to make it one thing, then that's when you drive yourself crazy and other people too.
Well, how did you learn about wine? Did you read books about it, take classes?
I tried, but I found that the absolute best way to learn about wine is to drink a lot of it. And that sounds funny, but it's true in almost any field that you go into, hobbies, skiing, golf, listening to jazz, opera, you simply have to immerse yourself in it. But
this is an impossible thing to really learn, because what might have been true with the 2000 vintage is not necessarily true for the 2001 vintage. And you can go really crazy unless you are a professional.
Well, but I don't think that's true. I think the differences in the vintages are there for sure. But in a larger sense, they're not so great that you can't learn the basic points about a wine simply by drinking it and having the experience and making yourself more comfortable.
As a serious wine drinker and critic, what are your thoughts about the availability and popularity of cheap, mass-produced wines like Yellowtail?
I they don't interest me.
But they're often called introductory wines.
Yeah,
Does that make sense to you?
No, that's a wine industry effort to rationalize buying those sorts of wines. I mean, most people who drink wine started out on milk or orange juice. You know, it's silly. To me, the analogy is with fast food or franchise food. Once you get serious about food and you start cooking and going to good restaurants, you're not satisfied with that sort of things for a whole host of reasons. And the same is true with wine.
Well, the wines you recommend in your Wednesday wine columns in the New York Times tend to retail for $20 and over. Can anyone who isn't wealthy drink wines that expensive every day?
Well, A, that's not true.
I said tend to.
Tend to,
there have been
yes.
exceptions.
I
but
mean, you know,
really, there aren't all that many $8 to $10
no,
wines
that's
in your
true.
Column.
And my feeling is that the real sweet spot for value and excitement now is $15 to $20. And I've done quite a few columns within those parameters. But, you know, in the old days, before science caught up with how wine is made, there were lots of bad, flawed wines. We didn't really know what went into the process. Now we understand, and almost any wine you buy is sound, but there are a lot of boring wines. There are a lot of palatable wines, but they're just not that interesting. So if you really want interest, you might find it for $10. You're a lot more likely to find it for $15 to
$20. Well, people in the wine business will tell you that a lot of wines are produced with certain almost national tastes in mind. There is an American love of big red wines, for example, and big white wines, Chardonnays. And then in France, it would be something a little more subdued. But right now there's an international style that's being developed and a lot of people don't like it.
Well, there are always stereotypes about what people like. And I think in the last part of the 20th century and the first 5 years of this century, you had a lot of producers around the world making wines, almost creating them to fit certain taste profiles. And it was assumed that American wine critics, whose scores sell lots of bottles, wanted those big, powerful, very fruity wines. The technical term for them is fruit bombs. I think that with the availability of high-speed internet and blogging and the ability to hear many different voices, the idea that only that style appeals to Americans or is popular around the world has really diminished. You're seeing a lot more different styles nowadays.
And those wines, the really big ones, can overwhelm a meal, can't they?
I personally feel so. I mean, they're not to my taste. A lot of people like them for one reason or another, but I just they're not my idea of a really fine wine.
Well, what happens if you're just drinking wine? You're not having a meal. Are they okay? For years, I was prejudiced against wine because I went to a lot of gallery openings, and the wines were always really awful, and I thought, oh, that's what wine is until I actually tasted a decent wine. There are times when you're just going to be walking around with a glass of wine. There are certain kinds that are more preferable.
As a California producer once said to me, who makes a big, powerful, fruity, alcoholic wine, he said, oh, these wines are not for drinking with food. They're for when you come home and you sit out on your deck and you have a glass. Yeah, I don't know. I prefer other sorts of wines or even a beer if I'm not drinking food.
Well, you don't seem to respect the whole matter of wine ratings or tasting notes. So how do you select a new bottle of wine that you might want to try? How much are you willing to pay for wine that you've never tasted before?
You know, I admit that I'm an odd case where I don't have to pay for a lot of bottles because I have an expense account.
And so, people also send you wines,
but, they do, but we don't really accept samples for using in our own tastings. But I personally do buy a lot of wine, and if I haven't tasted a bottle, you know, or for daily drinking, I'm spending in that $20 range, and I'm willing to do that. I've taken a flyer on a lot of wines and spent more.
Well, we're firmly in the middle of the holiday season, and a bottle of wine is a very popular gift.
Yeah.
Do you have certain wines that you are more likely to bring if somebody's invited you to dinner or somebody's invited you to a party?
Always champagne. I love champagne, and of course, this is the time of year when people drink more of it than any other time, but I give that year-round as a gift.
Now, when you say champagne, champagne has to be from Champagne. But there are some bubbly wines that are made in that method that are quite good.
Absolutely. So. There are good, very good California sparkling wines, Roederer Estate, Schramsberg, Scharfenberger, Iron Horse, very good. There are some really good East Coast sparkling wines. Lieb Cellars out in Long Island makes a great sparkling Pinot Blanc, which a lot of people don't know is an ancient grape that you could use in champagne.
Jancis Robinson has a new book out in which she traces all the various families of wines.
Yeah.
And some of them are stunning, stunningly surprising. You wouldn't suspect that certain wines are related, but DNA tests show they are. Would that matter to you at all?
Sure. It's of academic interest, but not really as far as enjoying a bottle or a glass. It's interesting to know what the oldest, most ancient grapes are, but.
And do you get involved with that whole matter of the terroir
Absolutely.
That winemakers love?
You know, I think that the greatest wines do show evidence of where the grapes were grown. But you know, a lot of people think of that French word terroir as a scary thing and of just representing a patch of dirt. But it's a lot more than that. It's also the climate. It's the angle towards the sun, and very important, it's the people who make the wine.
And the insects who are going through those vineyards.
Well, yeah, that's a natural part of it, but it's a culture. You know, really good wine represents a culture and expresses a culture, and that's what I love in good bottles.
Eric Asimov is the chief wine critic of the New York Times. His weekly column appears in the dining section every Wednesday, and now he's written a memoir and a manifesto, he says, called How to Love Wine. It's published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure.